Good morning, Connecticut, and to all our friends across the Sound, and happy holidays. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning, as we warm up from the winter's first deep freeze, we welcome the new executive director from Operation Fuel to remind you about the thousands of families, seniors, and neighbors facing challenges staying warm this winter and reminding you about how to help. We'll also review a few of the high points of Operation Fuel's 2016 Affordability Gap Report, and then we'll touch base with a couple of guests about the 2016 Zero Energy Challenge, including the developer of one of the state's newest homes to achieve near or complete zero energy output. Then we'll close our anticipated final new program of 2016 with a visit and radio tour of Bristol's Carousel Museum. That's the New England Carousel Museum. Are you looking for something new and interesting to do, or a great place to take your kids over holiday break? Then saddle up and stay tuned. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. Acts 4 Ministry and New Opportunities in Waterbury are seeking donations of new or gently worn winter coats and accessories for men, children, and women through Saturday, January 14th. The apparel they collect will be given away free to local area people in need on Martin Luther King Day. Through January 14th, donations can be brought to Acts 4 Ministry at 1713 Thomaston Avenue in Waterbury from 9 to 3 or on Saturdays from 9 to noon to receive a tax-deductible receipt. They can also be placed in a donation box outside the building 24/7. For more information, visit acts4.org. That's acts4.org. In other news, the Bridgeport Neighborhood Trust and Key Bank have relaunched a down payment assistance program to help low to moderate income first-time home buyers in Bridgeport. Under the payment assistance program, individuals who qualify based on family income thresholds can receive a grant of up to $15,000 toward down payment and or closing costs for purchasing a new home, as long as the buyer is able to put down at least 1% of the purchase price of that new home and agrees to other conditions. Anyone interested in learning more about this Bridgeport-based program can contact the Bridgeport Neighborhood Trust at 203-290-4255 or visit bntweb.org. Well, we are opening the program this morning with a great concern, as we have experienced our first freeze situation, our first frozen zone here in the state, with all kinds of warnings and things going out earlier in the weekend. We have been a friend and partner with Operation Fuel for so long, and we recently celebrated with an entire segment the retirement of Pat Rice, and we're so pleased to make a seamless transition to friendship with their new executive director, Karen Adamson, who's with us this morning. Karen, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the organization, and we need to get right into the business at hand, because obviously, you know, we had people that were really, really cold over the past few days. And I understand that while Connecticut's annual energy affordability gap has decreased for the past year, it's still pretty substantial. Your agency has just issued its latest Connecticut report on the home energy affordability gap. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's great. I'm really happy to be talking about that. There has been a slight decrease in the total affordability gap since our last study. However, it's based basically on the fact that there were lower energy costs in the last year. But we have a history that shows that energy costs can be variable on any kind of number of factors, political, global, climate issues. Just recently, we saw something in the current about some real concerns that the governor has about the cost of natural gas, which is a significant impact on so many of our families in Connecticut, and we may be seeing some real increases there. And the U.S. Energy Administration is actually, they will predict what the prices will be for the upcoming season, and they're looking at a range of a 5% increase for electricity to as much as a 36% increase in heating oil. So while, you know, we look at the last year and say, okay, things were better for costs, we really can't rely on that. Mm. Even more significantly, one of the things that our studies show is that we have an increase in the number of households with incomes that are at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. Mm. And what's significant there is that's the population really that we serve, that the federal energy assistance program serves. These are the folks who really fall into this affordability gap. They simply do not earn enough income to cover their costs. And so that increase of nearly 20,000 homes or households in the past year is really important.
Yeah, you do.
We continue to see more and more households. And we know that these are working families, sometimes families on fixed incomes, elderly and disabled. As that increases, then the need increases, of course.
Yeah, and we know that no matter how much costs for gas and electricity and oil may roll downward, when you have an exponential increase in the number of people who need the assistance, you're still running in the red all the time, or pushing to catch up and try and help everybody as much as you can or a little bit. But a lot of people who just, you know, write the check or push the button or click the mouse and pay their utility bills every month, or live in rentals where it's kind of factored in sometimes to the big picture, they may wonder, well, really, how many people in Connecticut actually need energy assistance? And last year it was like well over 300,000.
Right, and this year we're saying, you know, that's 222,000. It's significant. And not all of them avail themselves of the assistance that's available. They may find other resources, family resources, or they make different choices, some of which is impacting their families in other ways. So if you say, okay, well, we're going to put off some health care issues, or, you know, we're going to see if we can get food assistance or that kind of thing, that kind of shifting around of basic needs expenses is another way that people cope with the situation. And none of these things are really what we would want for healthy Connecticut families.
Right. And I just want to stop you there. 313,000 served last year, 322,000 anticipated for the coming year.
Right. And that's not actually the number that we serve. That's the number that we know will have trouble affording
challenged families.
Their
I get
bills.
It. I understand.
Last year, we actually served at Operation Fuel 7,700 households for a total of $1.18 million in assistance grants.
Okay.
So we're doing that piece of it. Frequently, what we are doing is backing up the federal assistance that people are eligible for, but there are very limited benefits to that. And frequently, people find themselves, kind of coming to, say, February, mm-hmm. they're out of assistance from the federal program, and that's when they turn to us to get through that last delivery of oil or whatever it's going to take.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we also provide assistance all year round. So often what we see is people will get through the heating system, but when we get into the spring or summer months, they've deferred their electricity bills, and now they're facing electricity shutoffs, which can be equally dangerous in terms of not having a way to cool their homes or refrigeration or the ability to cook. So that's why a few years back, Operation Fuel made the decision to provide year-round assistance. And that's now a significant part of the assistance that we provide.
Mm-hmm. 40 years strong now, Operation Fuel is still Absolutely. Celebrating its 40th year under their new executive director, Karen Adamson, who's with us on the line for a couple more minutes. Karen, so quickly walk us through how everybody can really virtually painlessly make a difference. It's really just checking a box on our utility bills, and that's where it all starts.
Yeah, that's one of the easiest and, as you say, painless ways to support your neighbors. And, you know, one of the things I want to make sure that we always stress is we break down the number of households that this affects by House and Senate districts. Mm-hmm. And this is every community. Every community has households that are affected. So when you make a donation on your utility bill by simply checking a box called Add a Dollar, and you literally add $1 to your payment, you're actually helping neighbors in your very own community. Over the years that we've had the Add a Dollar program, which I think started in the 1983, I think, mm-hmm. we've actually brought in $17 million in donations over all those years. So it, you know, it seems like, okay, $1 a month, but it does add up, and we really encourage all utility customers to make use of that. Of course, we love to have larger donations than that, and you can do that through the utilities, but it might be even easier to do it through our own website, which is operationfuel.org. Lots of opportunities to donate, again, to help your neighbors and their children and their loved ones make sure that they're both warm and have lights throughout the year.
Excellent. Karen Adamson is the new executive director for Operation Fuel. If you'd like to review the Home Energy Affordability Gap Study, go to operationfuel.org/our, OUR-publications/. And, of course, operationfuel.org for information on both taking advantage of the program and where one of your 107 fuel banks are here in Connecticut, as well as how to donate or support the organization. Karen, great to meet you, and look forward to a long and fruitful relationship and partnership with us at Connoisseur Media and the award-winning For the People. Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you soon. Well, if you were listening carefully earlier in the year, you heard us reaching out to home builders and developers across the state to get involved in the Zero Energy Challenge. And as I was discussing with my first guest of the day here, Mitch Gross from Eversource, it's nice to be able to start something and then come back around and find out the effect of our promotion earlier this year. So we are starting the program off with Mr. Gross, and we're going to get into a little bit about what the Zero Energy Challenge is. So Mitch, thanks for joining us again and keeping us up to speed on this really exciting kind of competition.
It is very exciting, John, and thank you for having me. And obviously, your message got out there because we have a record 23 entries for this year's version of the Connecticut Zero Energy Challenge. This is our seventh consecutive year, and 23 entries is the most ever. And they come from across the state. I'm looking right now at the website. Right, they come from places as far as Deep River. Let's see here: Canterbury, Old Saybrook, Vernon, East Windsor, Cheshire, Southbury, Ridgefield. They're from everywhere, and they all have one thing in common. They are home builders and contractors who are wrapping up that new high efficiency home with the expected completion date no later than January 31st of 2017, and they're all participating in Energize Connecticut's residential new construction program. So Well, a lot of good things going on, and we're very interested. And it's interesting to look at the website and check out these designs. There are some really good-looking homes going up across Connecticut.
Well, it's also awesome that they're all connoisseur media radio listeners, and the award-winning For the People will take 100% credit for that best year ever.
That's right.
Or share it with you easily, because I know you are out there working really hard on behalf of Eversource to get the word out, because ultimately, I would imagine many of the features that are kind of prototyping in some of these homes, 10 years from now are going to be everywhere.
I think that's a very safe assumption. You know, there, as time goes on, it's expected, you know, cities and states, we expect they will adopt more stringent energy efficiency standards. And, of course, homeowners and builders will have to meet them as best they can. You know, you'll see, I believe, an increasing demand for, you know, zero energy or as close to zero energy as possible.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Mitch, because there is an allowance for some energy use. Can you kind of drill into the weeds a little bit on some of the specific criteria in what qualifies all of these 23 entrants for this kind of friendly competition?
Sure, I'd love to. First of all, they're all taking advantage or have the opportunity to take advantage of special financial incentives offered through Energize Connecticut, which is smart on their part. They also have access to technical assistance from a home energy rating system professional. And that's important because when the judges take a look at all of these 23 entries, and by the way, we're going to have the winner announced in the spring of 2017, they're going to look at things like what's called the HERS index, the home energy rating system. They're going to look at things like the thermal envelope of the building, which really comes down to the air tightness, I guess is the best way to put it. How tight is the home? How well insulated is the home? And in most cases, or in many of the cases, these homes, they produce as much energy as they consume, hence the zero or net zero or zero energy challenge in the title of the contest. So they all have, you know, similarities that the judges have to really take a look at, take a look at the numbers and see how well the builders, the contractors, the homeowners have met those criteria as far as things like, as I said, the thermal envelope or the HERS index.
Well, it'll be cool to hear spring who the winners are, but there are five different areas of recognition. In the past, have these prizes overlapped on projects?
In some cases, yes, we've had winners who have been multiple category winners. They're rare, but it is possible. And honestly, John, I think the competition's going to be a lot tougher this time. Mm. As I said, you know, the most entries ever. These are all designers, builders, contractors that have done their homework. They know the technology. They're putting all of those, I guess you could say, bells and whistles into these homes. And you know, it's going to be tough, but the judges will take a look at the results, the numbers, and they'll make a decision. And if there is a home that, you know, maybe we'll have some ties this year, that would be nice to have a couple entries tie for, say, for instance, overall winner or most affordable cost to build, things like that. There are some very interesting categories. And as I said, a lot of choices to choose from as far as the judges go.
Hmm. And while we talked about the fact that a lot of the advancements that are going to be or are incorporated into the 23 Zero Energy Challenge entries this year, there are a lot of other reasons behind why these developers and designers, you know, go to these great lengths to not only design the homes, but then, you know, jump through the hoops to qualify for the challenge.
That is indeed true. You know, it's more than just, I think it's safe to say, if you would ask them, they would say it's more than just energy costs. And that's a big category unto itself. I think you'll agree. Everyone's looking to save on their energy bills. But when they get into things like air sealing and photovoltaic systems and super high efficiency heating, ventilating, and air conditioning systems. You know, these are, they've taken a major step forward. Why are they doing this beyond the energy costs? You know, you have to turn to the environment. These investments deliver tremendous environmental benefits. It decreases the demand for energy production. It reduces CO2 emissions. There's so many pluses for these investments and these major step forward, I guess, is the major step forward that these builders and these homeowners are taking.
Mm. Well, before we let you go, Mitch, and we go meet one of the participants who has qualified among the 23 for this year's Zero Energy Challenge, can you talk across the landscape of the entrance about one or two who may be using the most advanced, cutting-edge ideas, or is it like too many to mention?
There's too many to mention, and you know that's the job that these judges are going to have to kind of pick apart. You know, many of them are using, I should say, most of them, if not all, use things like these days advanced insulation materials, very high R-value insulation packages. As I noted, the things like the super high efficiency HVAC systems, they are investing in high efficiency water heating, including it could be on demand, it could be a solar hot water system. There are so many little nuances to the technology that's out there right now. It's very exciting, and it will result in some pretty outstanding entries, and great savings and even more for the homeowners.
Great. Well, we'll drill into one of those in depth with our next guest, who will be joining us momentarily, David Jones, mm-hmm. of it's Revival Homes.
Right, and, Revival Homes LLC, right.
Yeah, and so we're going to say farewell to you for now, Mitch, until we hear from you again on Energize Connecticut or Eversource business, or perhaps in the spring when the winners are announced. And thank you for the setup and the great, sort of laying the groundwork of information here, so people will better understand once we get into the conversation with David. So we thank you for your visit this morning, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you. Mitch Gross from Eversource. Well, now we're being joined by David Jones, who I may have alluded to was a competitor in this year's Zero Energy Challenge, where, in fact, he was one of the winners of the 2016 last year's Zero Energy Challenge. But more excitingly, he has more recently received the Department of Energy's Housing Innovation Award for innovation in affordable homes. So this is doubly exciting, not just that you were recognized here in Connecticut, David, but also on the national stage. Tell us a little bit about the home that has everyone looking your way.
Certainly. The Captain Residence is a 3-bedroom home located in Litchfield, Connecticut, which produces more energy than it will consume in a single year.
Wow.
Our primary design goal for this house was to demonstrate that the total cost to own a zero-energy home is lower than the cost to own a home built to code minimum standards. And we define total cost of ownership as cost of construction plus energy cost plus maintenance cost.
Okay. So I take it that you are part of the folks in the industry who really see some of these homes that are really kind of standing alone in the landscape as being prototypes, and we kind of alluded to this with Mitch Gross a few minutes ago, the kind of standalone hybrids, if you will, the Priuses of the home building industry will soon be everywhere.
Oh, yes. I think so. I think it's the future. Zero-energy homes and high-performance homes is the future of the industry. currently zero-energy homes are a very small percentage of all new homes, but high performance is becoming more mainstream than it was just, say, 10 years ago. And I believe all new homes today can and should be built as zero-energy homes, but it's going to take some time for consumers to demand it from the industry.
Yeah, and I know that earlier in the year when we kind of previewed the Zero Energy Challenge for this year, whose winners will be announced next spring, we talked a little bit about the cost. But let's remind the listeners, what is the upfront difference between building, say, a conventional home versus one that has zero energy capacity?
Well, actually, that may not be the right question, because what I think makes more sense is to look at the total cost of owning the home.
Okay.
The upfront cost differential depends on the approach you take to get there. In this particular house, our goal was to reduce the total cost of owning the home to the absolute minimum. So we went outside of what is a typical building practices here in Connecticut to get there. But that number is going to vary quite a bit from one house to another.
Okay, so taking a colonial or a raised ranch side by side on two neighboring lots and building one to the sort of progressive zero energy standard that you have already proven to be able to construct versus one that's built by just a team of contractors to what would be, say, typical of the neighborhood, that is not the best way to look at the cost value relationship of a zero energy component.
That's right, because the ongoing cost of ownership are going to be much higher in a traditionally built home. Once you get to a zero-energy home, especially one that focuses on reducing cost of operation and maintenance, the cost to own the home can be significantly less, although the cost to build the home is going to be, to some degree, more. And how much more depends on the specifics of the home.
And I also understand that there's some catching up that needs to be done on the part of building codes. Is that currently contributing to the reason why so few homes today are being built to the highest zero energy standards?
Well, states are currently or will be updating building codes to focus more on energy efficiency and zero energy standards, which will continue to help make this more mainstream. Due to the Energize Connecticut effort, Connecticut is actually ahead of most states in this area. But as homeowners begin to fully understand all the benefits of zero energy or high performance homes, I believe they're going to demand zero energy construction going forward.
So, from your perspective, then, as we head toward the end of our conversation, if you were to advise folks that have existing homes, are there any products or practices that you have integrated into your award-winning zero energy design that can be effectively retrofitted into an existing home to make a measurable difference in either the home's energy consumption or its ability to produce energy?
Well, people often ask how you can make an existing home into a zero-energy home, and that's extremely difficult and impractical to do. However, on existing homes, there is always a ton of low-hanging fruit that can improve the energy efficiency of the home. And I would recommend a home energy solutions audit, which will look for air leakage, which is a primary cause of energy loss, as well as a cause for mold and mildew within the home, and updating appliances and insulating attic spaces and other easier areas. So plenty of things that existing homes can do to significantly reduce their energy consumption.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you enlightening us a little bit as a as someone who's been through the system as we sort of kind of turn our attention towards spring and the announcement of the next round of Connecticut Zero Energy Challenge winners. David Jones is the builder and owner of Revival Homes LLC, and he was most recently honored nationally by the U.S. Department of Energy with and its Housing Innovation Award for innovation in affordable homes. And we congratulate you, David, on both those fronts. And you, and I, if I understand correctly, you are not participating or are a finalist in the current Zero Energy Challenge. Do you have your eye on the prize for a future project?
Yes, we do have another project that is in the pipeline. So we are looking at entering the competition going forward in 2017.
Fantastic. Well, maybe we'll be talking again then. Congratulations on the national award as well as the statewide award. And we'll be looking for your next great innovations in the Zero Energy Challenge here in Connecticut. Thank you so much. And folks, if you'd like to learn more about this program and take a look at the record-setting number of current participants in the Connecticut Zero Energy Challenge, it's easy to remember. You just go to ctzeroenergychallenge.com. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this. There are half a dozen licensed psychotherapists, mostly clinical psychologists, who have worked with an organization called Volunteers in Psychotherapy, or VIP, for years, seeing people with deeply troubling secrets, trauma, and heartache. These therapists have agreed to receive a fee from VIP that's half to one-third of their usual visit cost, and their clients only have to do 4 hours of volunteer work at a charity of their choice to earn each session. If you'd like to support the cause by making a donation or qualify to receive expert support in exchange for your gift of volunteer time, learn more by clicking on ctvip.org. All right, well, if all of the horses and the chickens and the pigs and the donkeys that were surrounding us were alive, you couldn't hear our program this morning over all the galloping, but they're all pretty quiet this morning, and that's because we are the special guests of the New England Carousel Museum here in Bristol, Connecticut. So pleased to be with the museum manager, Morgan Ergo. We love to take the radio station out into the world and introduce you to some of the fine gems and locations and destinations here in Connecticut, and we are certainly remiss in taking so long to get over here to Bristol to the Carousel Museum, but we're glad we're here. And so let's start with some of the basics. Morgan, give us a little bit of a history lesson on this incredible and gorgeous and quaint museum.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for coming. We're a nonprofit, and we've been around for 26 years. We started in 1990, and our mission is really to collect and preserve the antique carousel horses and preserve the memory and the history of the ride itself. And so we have a collection of about 90 horses and menagerie figures, like you said. And I'll add that we don't allow people to feed them while they're here either.
And interestingly enough, today as we're talking, you have a guest exhibit that has a wide range of carved and molded animals, but they're not all carousel pieces.
Yeah, some of them we have a small collection of rocking horses. We have some we have a Loof auto scooter from the 1950s, which is a, you know, more people know it as a bumper car. So we have some different sideshow and circus memorabilia, some posters and sideshow banners. So we have a little bit of everything for people who are looking for the entertainment Victorian era carousel pieces. And we also house a restoration department, so people come from all over the country to have pieces restored here. And we have a master carver and two master painters on staff as well. So we're very busy.
So how do folks like master carvers and master painters of carousel pieces, you know, come up in that profession? Are these children, grandchildren, and great grandchildren of you know, 19th and 20th century woodworkers?
Yeah, I mean, some people are. There are active descendants of master carvers. I believe the carousel over at Lenny and Joe's was carved by a descendant of the Denzel family, which is a landmark company that family that carved carousel horses in the heyday of carousel pieces. Mm. But the people who work here are artists that have, you know, just gravitated towards the tradition of carousel carving. And Judy Baker, our master artist, she just, when she puts a brush to these animals, they just come alive. Mm. They really, mm. really do. And Juan Andrew, who's our master carver, he carved a lot of pieces that are in the museum, a lot of our modern carvings. We have a Jonathan Husky, a Yukon Jonathan Husky for the Husky fans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he just gets the hair. I mean, it's just amazing. They really do come to life. It's wow. It's pretty incredible.
That's great. Yeah. Well, if you could give us a little bit, to the extent that you can, of the history of the carousel. It would seem to me, based on the occasional appearances that they make in films mm-hmm. at certain points in history, that they my guess would be that they may be one of, if not the oldest moving type of amusement ride.
Absolutely, absolutely. They were actually started back in medieval times when Persian knights would toss bottles of perfume back and forth to each other. And the term "the smell of defeat" comes from that term. They would pass around bottles of perfume to each other as they were riding and training. And then in medieval French times, when knights were training for their jousting, their pages would operate wooden circular rides to practice, and the knights would have to get their jousting sword through a small circle, which was where the term "the brass ring" came from, catch the brass ring. So as these kinds of training methods evolved, people started to say, oh, that looks like it would be fun, and it became really one of the first amusement rides that we know of. And early on in the Victorian days, they were not for children, and certainly not for ladies. They were a man's ride, and then the chariots were installed so that women in their lovely gowns could sit and participate as well. And you know, Coney Island is really the heyday of the American carousel, and carvers from all over the world were immigrating to the United States, and we would, you know, we just had, you know, the pick of the litter as far as carvers, and they just tried to outdo one another. I mean, there was, I think, about 30 carousels in Coney Island at the heyday of carousel rides. Yeah, amazing.
So the turntable device that was the precursor to the modern carousel as we know it was actually a military training device.
Yeah, absolutely. You could say that. Yeah.
Very interesting. And were the pieces on which the folks rode, were they always kind of carved hoofed animals?
I believe so. I believe they started as horses, and then, you know, certain I believe the there's a carousel in Rhode Island, and the name is going to escape me at the moment, but it was designed with a variety of different animals. It was a showcase for the carvers there, and they were all different kinds of animals.
Okay.
And so, you know, different people, I mean, I've seen carousels with dogs. Juan Andrew, our carver here, has done an endangered species carousel. So there's all different kinds of animals, and kids love them. Kids love them.
And is there a breakdown between how many privately owned carousels that there are versus ones that are public? Do a lot of, or I guess a better question is, as far as you know, are there, would I be shocked to find out how many people have carousels on their personal property?
You know, that's a good question. I'm sure there's more than we know of. You know, but Connecticut is fortunate. We have about 14 antique carousels still in operation that the public can go to. And there's a website called the Magnificent Carousels of Connecticut. And people can go there and see what carousels are still in operation. At one point, I think we had over 200 wooden carousels operating. So we're down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And that's part of our mission is to preserve, you know, the the history of these pieces so that people understand why it's important to save them. We have several pieces originally from Lake Compounds, which we know is the oldest amusement park. And so we have an original horse from Lake Compounds. But in the Depression era, so often they were these carousels were dismantled and, you know, used for firewood. And so the fact that some of them still remain is really incredible.
Are there any other little known points of fact or trivia that often surprise people as they're going through the museum and asking their questions?
Yeah, it's a very in-depth art form, and I'm fairly new. I started here at the museum in July, and I'm still, you know, learning about them. And there's so much depth to what these pieces are. You can come in and read a lot about the animals and the pieces and the carvers, but when you come and take a tour. We try to get as many people on tour because there's so much to learn about them. But one of the things that people would be surprised to know is that there's three different styles of horse carving. There's the country fair style, which is a simpler, you know, traveling style, which a lot of people know from, you know, going to fairs and carnivals around town. There's the Philadelphia style, which is a very regal, authentic, realistic horse style. And then there's the Coney Island style, which is flamboyant and has lots of gems and gold leafing. And so there's three main body styles, but then there's three main body positions. There's the standers that don't go up and down. There's the prancers that have two legs forward. And then there's the jumpers, and those are the most popular because those are the ones that go up and down completely. And then there's all kinds of head styles and carving styles for tails. I mean, it goes on and on. It's the history of the carousel and the detail and the types of carvings that there are. It's really incredible.
And I guess over the years, as carousels may have gotten sold and dismantled and moved and relocated, or the pieces were taken on and given back by private owners. There's been some modifications to the original designs where the owners actually installed various types of tackware or other kinds of decorative bling to the horses.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have a handful of pieces in the museum that have their original tack, have their original leather, have their original saddles and bridles. It's really incredible. And some of these pieces are from the 1800s, you know, 1890. But along, you know, certain people, you know, over time, just like everything with car restoration or painting restoration, you know, certain techniques become fashionable and then don't. And so, you know, we try very hard to maintain the original restoration when pieces come here. We try not to, you know, do too much new painting or, you know, depending on what the owners are looking for. But there is a certain, style called park paint. A lot of pieces have what we call park paint on them, and that's when, you know, your general maintenance guy at the end of the season goes slaps some, you know, regular paint on, and unfortunately, you know, it covers up some really beautiful paint jobs that the pieces originally came with. We actually have a dental lion that we use a heat gun treatment. We don't use chemicals to strip the pieces because of the wood and the glue that's underneath. And we have a dental lion that we heat strip the whole thing, and he's so beautiful. His wood is so beautiful. We didn't restore it. The owner chose not to put paint on him, so he's here in the galleries with no paint on, and he's just absolutely stunning.
That's
great.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but before we do, are virtually all the pieces here in the Carousel Museum, the New England Carousel Museum in Bristol, American?
No, actually, we have quite a few pieces that are European. We have a couple pieces from Mexico. We have some pieces from Germany, some pieces from France. So there's pieces all over the world. And just a quick note that the outside of a carousel piece is highly decorative, and it's usually carved by the master carver. And the inside is less carved, and that's called the apprentice side. And so European carousels actually go clockwise, and American carousels will go counterclockwise. So you can tell a piece by the side that has the most decoration and which way it's supposed to be, quote unquote, facing.
Okay,
you know.
Great. Yeah. Well, we're going to be straight up with the second half of the show when we tease you with a little bit of trivia about one of the famous people that has actually held events here. We'll tell you guys out in the audience how you can have an event here at the Carousel Museum, or maybe come by with your family, friends, school group, and take advantage of some of the other activities. They have a huge calendar of both special and regular events. Well, it's pretty quiet here, but if we walked to the other side of the New England Carousel Museum, we would certainly hear the calliope sounds of the carousel that they actually have operating here. There's actually two parties that are going on. I saw people coming in with presents and catering and stuff. It's not just a carousel museum here on Riverside Avenue in Bristol, and we really appreciate Morgan Ergo, the museum manager, for having us here today and to help us sort of unveil and reveal these incredible places that we have in Connecticut. Hopefully you'll be able to visit at some point. If you'd like to find out more, they're of course on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or you can just check them out online at thecarouselmuseum.org. So Morgan, let's talk a little bit about reoccurring or specialty programs that you have here, and then we'll give people a few clues on how they can have their own party or event here, like Paula Abdul did way back in the early 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, she was one of the first people that had her wedding here. She had her East Coast wedding here, and I believe it was in 92, but don't quote me on that. It was early 90s. Yeah, it's an absolutely fantastic venue, but we do family events. We have regularly occurring family events. Family Sunday is the second Sunday of each month where the museum's open. We offer a themed craft for each month for the kids and parents to do, because we know that parents like to get hands-on. Mm-hmm. And then we do a children's geared tour. We have a lot of different hands-on activity stations to keep little hands busy in the museum, because that can be tough, knowing that, you know, they get so excited and they're so used to jumping on carousels and riding them. And so often we forget that these are pieces of artwork that kids can ride on and touch. So we have a lot of things to keep their hands busy, you know, different activity, you know, gears and different ways to show how carousels operate. So we try to get a little of that mathematics and science slipped under the radar as well.
Excellent. Now, I'm excited to hear about the Crocodile Club, although it only happens, I guess, once a year. It's quite popular.
Yeah, Crocodile Club happens usually in August. We hold it at Lake Compounds. It's the longest running, I believe, political event. It's a social dinner that celebrates the coming together of when Bristol and Southington agreed to move the line of Southington for Bristol to accommodate Lake Compounds to be in one town. So it's a tradition that's going on about 136 years, and it's a friendly roast. We have a luncheon, and political people come and you know, kind of take very friendly jabs at each other. But it's a great event, and it's held usually in August. We hold that, so that'll be coming out.
Yeah. And I'm sure that we're not, you know, telling a lot of people about something brand new to them, because you host thousands of school children every year who make it a point to come and look at this beautiful artwork.
Yeah, we do. We encourage you know, children to come for teachers to come take their classes. You know, it's an ideal place to have a lot of fun, but also to talk about, you know, centrifugal force and talk a lot about physics. And you know, we like to engage school groups in that. We actually have the Bristol School Systems are coming in, and they're going to do National Pi Day with us, and we're going to have a nice family night for the Bristol school kids. So we encourage everybody to come and to use us for what suits their needs. You know, a lot of people come to do, you know, community service or, you know, to do events here. And we do all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And there is a symbiotic partnership with the Bushnell Park Carousel?
Yeah, we've actually been operating the Bushnell Park Carousel for about 16 years. And we run the day-to-day operations for the city of Hartford. And this year we were honored to receive the National Carousel Association's Historic Restoration Award. Yeah, it was a unanimous decision that we were to receive that award, and it was we were the only ones to receive that this year. So that was a huge honor to not only the carousel itself, but to our restoration staff that's been restoring that for the past 15 years. So if you haven't had a chance to ride the Bushnell Park Carousel, it's absolutely fabulous. It's completely enclosed right now, weatherized. Actually, if you go down down there during the month of December on Saturdays. Santa's down there from noon to 3. You can take a picture with Santa and then ride the carousel for a dollar. So you can spend the whole afternoon there for a dollar, and I don't know where you can get that much fun anywhere else.
Excellent. Well, there's some standalone programs we want to talk about that are coming up in the coming weeks and months, all the way into the springtime, actually, of 2017. So let's look out into the distance, because I guess if people want to come and be part of the Body Art and Tattoo Show, they need to start thinking about getting that tattoo now.
Yeah. So we're going to be opening a tattoo show in the beginning of June. It's going to be Inked, the History of Body Art and Tattooing. So it'll cover, you know, the gamut of the history of tattooing. And it's a perfect fit with what we do here in a kind of our circus sideshow carnival atmosphere. Yeah. But it'll also hit, on henna and, you know, military style tattoos and body art and those kinds of things. So I'm really, really, really excited about that show. For the rest of the December, we'll be open. The museum will be open Monday through Friday for school vacation week. We'll have crafts and tours and storytelling. And also the Bushnell Park Carousel will be open Monday through Friday of the vacation week, that week between Christmas and New Year's as well.
Great.
So, yeah.
Tell us about Firehouse Friends.
Oh, Firehouse Friends. So we are also home to the Museum of Fire History, which was a collection donated to us by Hap Barnes, who is a local legend. And he's got, he donated to us his complete fire history memorabilia collection. So there's bells that kids can ring and, you know, alarms that they can sound and fire chief hats that they can try on. And it's all authentic pieces. And so when I first came on, I noticed that we didn't have a lot of programming that surrounded that. So Firehouse Friends is a story time and safety instruction kind of for preschoolers, where we introduce them to different materials and techniques about fire safety. But then we do a craft and we have fun and ride the carousel.
And the older kids and kids of all ages love the steampunk. What's that all about?
Yeah, so steampunk is actually the Brass Ring is the event. So the brassringct.com is where people can go to check out the full line of activities. But that's coming up January 7th and 8th. It's Saturday and Sunday. We have a various roster of workshops and performances. There'll be a burlesque thing at night, so there's going to be 2 full days of steampunk style activities and evening events that will be happening here. And it just takes place throughout the whole museum, so it's kind of Victorian era. It's sailors, valentines, brass goggles, performances, and like I said, burlesque troupes. And so they kind of just take over the museum and have a blast, and we kind of turn back the clock a little bit on that.
Yeah. And you engage folks, fledgling artists here with the adult drawing?
Yeah, so we also are launching,
raffling somebody off.
Yeah, we're trying to really refocus the community of artists in the Central Connecticut area. There's a lot of places that people can go to, but we're trying to also be a hub where people can learn about art and learn about sculpture and woodworking and carving, and drawing is the beginning of all of that. So we're starting that as well. We also have our changing exhibition gallery, so we like to feature local artists as well as often as we can. So we try to really reach out to the members of the art community as much as possible. So, okay. And as an artist myself, it's huge. Yeah. It makes a difference when you have affordable places to participate in those kinds of activities.
Excellent. And finally, Mix It Up. What's that all about?
So Mix It Up is your 6 through 9 year old classes. It's a variety, mixed media. We mix it up every time. Every time that we have a activity or a class, we have a different, we use a different material, whether it's watercolor or sketching or line drawing, cartooning, introducing young people to a lot of materials that they're not getting in school these days, different materials. We're very fortunate that many people use us as a place to donate a lot of their material. So, in addition to having our regular program budget, we are recipients of a lot of donations of art materials. So we can, silk screening and, exposing kids to new materials that they might not know exist.
And it really is kind of like a mall of museums here, because it's not just the Fire History Museum and the Carousel Museum, but also Greek History Museum. Is that right?
Yeah. We have a small museum of Greek culture, and it's really great. I do a lot of I tie that into the carousel theme with the Trojan horses, but there's a variety of things that they can do. So upstairs in our second floor, we have the restoration department, the Museum of Greek History, and the Museum of Fire History, as well as the ballroom.
So this is not a quick in and out for folks planning a visit.
Yeah, I mean, a regular tour takes about an hour, depending on how fast or slow you want to go through. There's, tons of, descriptions and labels for people to read, but every person that comes through gets a tour, and a guided tour where they really are introduced to the world of carving. But it's amazing how many people come here and know a lot about it as well.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I, as a first-time visitor, I could tell you the minute you come through the door into the main room, it just it takes you back. It makes you feel like a kid again, but as an adult, you also can't help but be immediately struck by the incredible craftsmanship and artistry and beauty of these many pieces, even the rustic and the pieces that are are not in their restored mm-hmm. condition. Mm-hmm. Even the old Lay Compounds piece that was almost tossed onto the fire for firewood is beautiful, even in its several pieces that you have here. So hopefully folks will hear this and they'll be very receptive to coming out. But also, as we mentioned, it's good enough for Paula Abdul to have her wedding. You also have everything from kids' parties on up to any type of testimonial catered event or milestone event, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2014, we purchased and installed a miniature carousel. It has about 16 horses on it, and that has really boosted people's interest to come here and have kids' birthday parties as well. They are very affordable, and we can do crafts with them. But a lot of people come in, they have their birthday party. The kids get to ride unlimitedly on the carousel. It's a blast. And what's really nice is that it's appropriate for all ages. You get 12-year-olds who love the carousel, and you have one-year-olds that love the carousel. Everybody, you can't deny that it's a fun time. And there's a teacup. The older kids like to spin themselves silly on the teacup. And then we have our ballroom on the second floor, which is, as far as I know, one of the few venues in central Connecticut that is of its kind. It's got amazing crystal chandeliers, and we can seat like 225 people. Comes with the tables and chairs. You can't beat it.
Excellent. Lots to do here and lots to see at the Carousel Museum, the New England Carousel Museum, here on Riverside Avenue in Bristol, and also partnering with and overseeing the Bushnell Park Carousel. You can check them out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or online at thecarouselmuseum.org. We appreciate being the guest here today in this beautiful and magical environment. Morgan Ergo is the museum manager. We appreciate. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.